It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On Tuesday's ballot, voters considered whether to support additional funding for schools in many communities.
According to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, more than 100 referendums passed in this election, while 30 failed. Researcher Ari Brown told WPR,
I will say this is actually the lowest passage rate across an entire midterm or presidential election year since 2014. We're getting a 70.1% overall passage rate across 241 referendum this year.
We're digging into two of the successful ballot measures, $183 million for the Green Bay Area Public School District and $54 million for the Unified School District of Antigo.
And the superintendents join us now, Glenda Ojinski from the Antigo Schools. Glenda, welcome to Wisconsin Today. Hi, Glenda.
Thank you for having
me. Yes, good. And Vicki Beyer is here in Green Bay. Vicki, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Vicki, let's start with you. $183 million referendum for Green Bay schools, passing with two-thirds of voters supporting it. Did you expect this outcome?
My goodness. We were hopeful. We've been out in the community for the last 3-4 months and receiving really positive feedback, but to see the actual results, it's overwhelming, and we're so grateful.
How will this referendum affect local taxpayers? Can you break that part down?
Yeah, I would love to. Our mill rate was at $8.26, and because of the way we've managed our money over the last couple of years, we're able to pass a $183 million referendum and actually lower the mill rate. So now we are under $8. And that's that was a goal of ours all along. We're down to $7.65, and we're really proud of that.
How does that work, a tax rate decreasing with the passage of this referendum?
Yeah, well, we've been paying off our debt, and that means we're able to borrow at a lower interest rate. So we're in a really good position in Green Bay financially.
Glenda, on Tuesday, voters approved $54 million to support the Unified School District of Antigo. How significant is this funding for your schools?
It will have a tremendous positive impact on what we are able to do for our school district. And much like Green Bay, we are so thankful to our community for coming out and supporting us. It's been a long time coming for Antigo, and it's been since 1998. Since we passed a successful referendum. So we are thrilled and very excited to get things started so that we can be even more grateful and show our community what we're able to do with this additional funding.
Well, Glenda, since 1998, what made the difference this time around?
We spent a lot of time, my administrative team and myself, along with our board members, visiting all of our town halls, the villages. We have Antigo School District covers about 19 municipalities along with 3 counties. So we spent a lot of time making sure that we were able to share information with everyone so that there was accurate information so our voters had, you know, an opportunity to make an educated decision when it came time for them to report to the polls to cast their ballot. And I think that made a great deal of difference. Just the amount of communication we were able to get out and talk with people and give them factual information.
You had to reach many neighbors across 3 counties. That is just a lot of area to cover to get your message out.
Yes, absolutely. And it was very important that we be able to do that. And there were many nights that we had 3 events taking place where we were dividing and conquering and having videos prepared so that we were sharing consistent factual communication with our community.
Vicki, the Wisconsin Policy Forum did some analysis on the referendums, and researcher Ari Brown told WPR this week that there is a science of choosing when and how to go to referendum. Can you talk a little bit about that approach? When and how did the decision to go to referendum come about for Green Bay?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I do want to clarify when I said we are financially in a good spot, that was specific to referendum. That's separate from our general budget, where we have a lot of work to do, but that's a different topic. The science of when and how is really based upon past referendum. And were we able to off in a reasonable amount of time to impact interest rate if we were to come back and borrow again. So we really based it on that and our need to consolidate schools. So it wasn't just about the money. It was about what do we need to do in the district looking long term to best set up the community in our district for the future of decreased enrollment. So this referendum does focus on consolidation of schools.
When you say consolidation of schools, there's a financial impact to that. Can you explain what you mean there?
Yes, ma'am. We have declining enrollment and a budget deficit, much like other districts in the state of Wisconsin. And to address that, we are closing six schools and consolidating. So long term, that's going to be in the best interest of the district financially.
We're talking with superintendents in Northeast Wisconsin about their successful referendums in Tuesday's election. Vicki Beyer there, interim superintendent of the Green Bay Area Public School District. Glenda Oginski with us, superintendent of the Unified School District of Antigo. Glenda, I understand a significant portion of the funding will focus on safety improvements for your schools. What will be done?
So, along with the construction of a new elementary school, we will focus a lot of efforts on safety, making sure that we have at least a two barrier vestibule, that we are screening our visitors to make sure that we are providing safe, secure entrances for all of our buildings, along with replacing some outdated fire systems at the high school and middle school. And there's the need to replace even interior doors. Our middle school currently has doors that are original to the build of the middle school, which was in 1938. So making sure that we have good doors for the interior of the existing buildings will also be part of these referendum dollars.
And you also have some upgrades to emergency technology in classrooms.
Correct. Yes, there will be systems put in place to make sure that we currently practice ALICE drills, but to make sure that we have the ability to press a button and be able to lock down our wings of our schools so that, you know, it's more difficult if we were to have an intruder for them to be able to break through those barriers.
Vicki, in Green Bay, you will also have some focus on safety and security upgrades with through the referendum. What are you facing there?
Yeah, very similar to what Glenda is describing, and it's so sad that our schools have to deal with this. But we have a few schools remaining where we want to enhance the main entrances to the buildings, and we're going to utilize funds from this referendum to do so.
You know, Vicki, projects funded through school referendums, that can sometimes take years to come to fruition.
Yeah.
What will happen between now and when construction would begin, or when community would be able to start seeing the difference?
Yeah, we planned for two scenarios. One would be passage and one not passing, because we have to move forward with school consolidation regardless. So the teams got to work right away Wednesday morning. And we have a drafted timeline that we will be sharing with our Board of Education on Monday night. And we're looking at about 2 or 3 years of construction. Just like Glenda, we will be building a new elementary school. And we have that a draft timeline mapped out for that as well.
When you're seeing such consolidation, why build a new elementary school?
Yeah, that's a great question. For financial reasons, it's actually cheaper to build a new building than it would be to put funds into the repairs and maintenance of the three older buildings. So we will close three schools on the west side and consolidate them into a brand new building. More energy efficient and long term, it's going to save the district money.
Wow. Glenda, is that a similar strategy with a new elementary school for Antigo?
Yes, absolutely. We will be closing the three existing elementary buildings and consolidating, and we will be doing some grade configuration changes. Currently, our elementaries serve grades 4K through third grade, and we will be removing our fourth grade students from middle school and placing them at the elementary. So the new elementary will be inclusive of 4K through fourth grade. And just like Vicky in Green Bay, we too, it's a cost savings. The operation of one building is greater fiscal responsibility than trying to maintain three outdated buildings that need a lot of repairs.
I want to land, Vicky, on funding, because on Tuesday after the election, State Superintendent of Education Jill Underly said in a statement that the legislature has severely underfunded public schools for well over a decade, and it has led to a record number of districts going to referendum to try to fix severe financial constraints on their own. Does Underly's assessment match up to what Green Bay is doing here with the referendum?
100%. And that's why I regret that I said we're financially in a good spot and want to, again, clarify that's regarding referendum only. I'll give you an example. Special education is grossly underfunded and with reimbursement. Schools are reimbursed at a rate of about 30% right now in the state of Wisconsin. The impact for Green Bay Area Public School District, just our district, means that we have to take $32 million out of our general fund every year and move out of our general fund and move it over to special education. That's just for that group of students, 18% of our student population. We faced a budget deficit of $36 million 3 years ago. It's because of things like this, lack of reimbursement from the state. I could go on and on about where the state is really falling short on supporting public education, and that includes money to private and vouchers.
Well, Vicky and Glenda, thank you so much for joining us and giving a glimpse of your districts.
Appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Vicky Beyer, Interim Superintendent of Green Bay Area Public School District, and Glenda Ojinski, Superintendent of the Unified School District of Antigo, that's in Northeast Wisconsin, talking about their successful ballot measures in Tuesday's election and how they will use the additional funding.
Coming up, citizens of tribes in Wisconsin respond to President Biden's recent apology for the abusive Native American federal boarding school system that lasted for 150 years.
It was a major step forward to actually, you know, expend federal resources to take a hard look at the impact of boarding schools.
That conversation is ahead on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In a speech last month in Arizona, President Joe Biden apologized for the federal government's 150-year history of running abusive boarding schools for Native American children. He called it a blot on American history.
I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize.
Thousands of children experienced abuse, neglect, and forced assimilation. That legacy was passed on through generations. As a warning, this conversation includes details of those abusive conditions.
Mary Annette Pember writes about her mother's experience at one of these institutions here in Wisconsin in a forthcoming book called Medicine River. Pember is a national correspondent for ICT News and a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Mary, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
And Travis Miller is here, treasurer for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. Travis is a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohicans from North Central Wisconsin. Travis, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Travis, what feelings came up for you when you heard President Biden forcefully apologizing for the government's trauma with these boarding schools?
Oh, it was a relief to hear an apology coming from such a high level in our federal government. I think it's long overdue and something that, you know, survivors and descendants of survivors have been waiting for many years.
Mary, what was this moment like for you? What did those words mean?
Well, you know, of course, I was working as a journalist and covering it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that capacity, I often kind of compartmentalize my feelings. But later, I mean, I did feel it was very important, and I was really struck at how he really listed the ways in which the federal government utilized boarding schools as an act of assimilation. And I think unlike some other apologies, for instance, by the Catholic Church and the U.S. Council of Bishops, he didn't try to backpedal it at all. And I was really impressed with that.
Hmm. I want to look further, Mary, at the Interior Department led by Deb Haaland releasing that final investigative report over the summer detailing the horrific history of Indian boarding schools, federal Indian boarding schools. What is your reaction to that report? Was it thorough? What did you gain from it or see from it?
Well, I think it wasn't as thorough, certainly, as it could have been, but I think some of it speaks to just how scattered all of the kind of boarding school records are in this country. But it was a major step forward to actually, you know, expend federal resources to take a hard look at the impact of boarding schools. You know, I think the number of children that they found that, quote unquote, died, I think is far lower than the people who did actually die. There were many. We do know from other research that thousands of children were sent home before they actually died, when they were like mortally ill and died at home, and then consequently spread, often it was frequently tuberculosis-related illnesses, and then spread those to their communities. But given with the resources they have and the scattered nature of these records, I think they did a really good job. And I think it's extremely important, and it sets now a baseline, if you will, in the United States. People can no longer claim that they didn't know about this. This is like a history that was hidden, quote unquote. I mean, it's out there front and center. This is a federal report. So I think it's extremely important.
With this report, Travis, it calls for the return of lands that once housed these boarding schools and to, you know, put up memorials to the children who were separated. What do you make of these actions, and how might that land process, that land transfer take place?
So I think one of the important aspects of returning the land to the tribes that were affected by specific Indian boarding school locations, as we had earlier mentioned, the children that had passed while in the custody of these schools, these institutions, there may still be burial sites that have not been identified. There may be cultural resources held at these institutions. So when we think about the return of the land, we think about the return of, you know, what comes with that land.
We're talking about the legacy of Native American boarding schools with Mary Annette Pember. She's a journalist, author, and citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And Travis Miller, treasurer for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and member of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohicans. I would like to turn to your personal stories. And Mary, you have a forthcoming book that follows the story of your mother, who was forced to attend one of these schools. Can you explain to us a bit about what your mother's experience was like?
Yes, she went to school there, you know, in the 30s, and it was a difficult time. It was during the Great Depression. We found that many people, you know, their Native people's lands and resources were so diminished by many of these policies in the late 19th century that people often were forced to utilize boarding schools as a way to survive. And that was really kind of what happened with my mother's family. Her parents broke up and there was really no place for them to go. And although traditionally Ojibwe families would normally take children of parents who were indisposed in some way, unfortunately, that tradition really had been dismantled, you know, by these economic policies. And so they were forced to go to what they called it then the sister schools, St. Mary's Indian boarding schools on the Bad River Reservation in Odena, Wisconsin. For her, it was, you know, she often spoke about the sister school and just the real emotional and physical pain of attending a school. And I think it was, you know, sort of a trauma and a subsequent PTSD that she never really fully recovered from. And she would talk to me as a child. It was sort of my fairy tales, if you will. And I think she often kind of cleaned them up a little bit so that she would often come out on top, you know, for my benefit. But I was always very aware of the impact of the sister school on her. And in many ways, you know, she passed on a torch, if you will, for me to tell her story. She placed me on this quest, you know, that I was really imbued with this duty to tell her story. And I mean, she was well aware that most people didn't know about this. So I've always known about the sister school.
How did your mother's experience affect your relationship with her?
Well, she was, as I said, she was, you know, at that time, we didn't know about PTSD and the impacts of trauma. And she clearly, you know, suffered from the effects of that. And she had difficulty parenting us, you know, and expressing love and affection. And she was also sort of this hyper-vigilant person. You know, living with her was kind of like walking on eggshells all the time. And we were guilty for some transgression, you know, we didn't know of. So I, as I grew older, I came to see that there was obviously something going on that went far deeper than anything about our relationship together. And that motivated me to take a deep dive into why she was the way that she was, which, you know, I think it helped inform me and gave me some authority over how, what drove her to behave the way that she had behaved. I was speaking with Denise Lajmadeer, who's actually also works for the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and has written extensively about her parents' boarding experience. And Denise said, you know, once she learned about what happened to her parents and what happened to them, she had to forgive them. And I think that for me has this story is very much about my journey to understanding and forgiveness of her.
Travis, how has your family been affected by the boarding schools? What would you be able to share?
I'm a descendant of multiple grandparents who have attended boarding schools. My grandfather, my mom's dad. So he attended the Lutheran Mission School on the Stockbridge-Munsee Reservation. And he was one of the last groups of children to be sent there before its closure. And although he only attended for a few years, I believe, between the ages of 6 and 10 years old, I can tell how it affected him. I really think it diminished his sense of tribal identity, that pride that a lot of us hold as tribal people. He didn't have that. And it used to really bother me when I was young, because I grew up, you know, although his experience kind of put him in a place where culture wasn't a priority for him. So my mother grew up without that. She grew up, you know, missing that part of her identity. She really made it a point to make sure that her children, myself included, were always immersed in our culture, in our ceremonies. So I grew up with that. And I remember as a kid thinking, man, how come my grandpa doesn't participate? You know, how come he doesn't even support our participation in either cultural activities or ceremonial activities? And as I got older, into my teenage years, I really started participating even heavier, you know, in our ceremonies. And I would want to talk to my grandfather about it. Me and him always had a really good relationship. He would come pick me up every day during the summers. Pick me up, and without any real type of plan, we'd just drive around the res, you know, listen to his old country music, laugh, hang out, go visit other relatives. You know, so I had a close relationship with him, but not being able to feel like I could share that experience, you know, those cultural experiences, ceremonial experiences with him, as I got into my teenage years, really started to and a negatively impact our relationship, because, you know, these things were so important to me. And there were times where he would make jokes about it, you know, make jokes about our ceremonies or the things that we did, poke fun at them. And that at the time really hurt me. And you know, as I grew and matured and started understanding more of this history, boarding school policy history, and, you know, the impacts it had on him, it really allowed me to, you know, look at it from a different perspective. There were times when I would get upset, you know, you'd make jokes and I would get upset. It's definitely been part of my healing as well, you know, understanding, you know, what he went through, what his father went through. I have so many of my grandparents, you know, experienced the Indian boarding schools. And I think probably with a lot of the same outcomes, really diminishing their sense of personhood as a tribal person. And, you know, that trickles down from generation to generation and really impacts the preservation of your cultural practices, your beliefs, your worldviews. So I experienced that throughout my life, you know, as a secondhand survivor, a descendant of many survivors of the boarding school policies.
Mary and Travis, thank you so much for sharing those deeply personal stories and giving us more of a glimpse into the effects of these schools. Travis, I want to move on to the Healing Coalition and the work it's doing in collecting the oral histories from boarding school survivors and their families. Can you talk about this work and where it's going?
Yeah, so the Oral History Project, so NABS, when I say NABS, I'm talking about the coalition. NABS has accepted a grant from the Department of Interior to conduct video interviews with Indian boarding school survivors across the United States with the purpose to create a permanent oral history record and collection. NABS has built trust with multiple American Indian and Alaskan Native communities and are working to collect survivors' stories in a healing-informed way. Mm. So this is allowing the survivors of the boarding schools to really tell their story from their perspective. And our mission is to collect these stories. You know, our relatives that have attended these schools, they're getting older. We're losing people every day that have attended these schools. So in an effort to, you know, really preserve this history, we are collecting the survivor stories.
Mary, are these oral histories, do you think they are a healing step?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just do want to say this. There's been a lot of emphasis in the media on quote unquote healing. Mm-hmm. And like people want to jump to that very quickly, but healing needs to be preceded by truth. And I think really in many ways, that's the area that these histories occupy is truth. People do have the opportunity to express that truth, their personal truth, and then the American public needs to hear it. You know, we look to our relatives in the North there in Canada. They spent a great deal of time also collecting people's stories, you know, and they started the work in 2008 and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I remember speaking to Chief Willie Littlechild, who was a commissioner on that commission, and he said that they had done a poll looking at the awareness that the Canadian public had of residential schools, and they thought that perhaps 2% of people were aware. But by the time it was all finished, they did another poll and found that over 50% of the Canadian public was aware of the residential school history. And I think that's something that this collection and awareness of these histories really contributes to the public's knowledge of this history of their own countries.
There are now schools around the country that teach Native American languages and culture. Travis, what do you think the future looks like for teaching Native American languages and culture and trying not to lose any more, especially of the language?
Yeah, I really love to see the increase in language programs, schools that are providing indigenous language courses and curriculum. I love seeing that. It's been something that has definitely strengthened the preservation of language. We see multiple immersion schools throughout the country popping up. And I think the future, I think we see more of these schools coming in into fruition and maybe more federal funding to support these initiatives for language. Mary had mentioned earlier about Canada's Truth and Healing or Truth and Reconciliation Commission. One of the things that NABS is advocating for right now is a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding School Policies Act. And with these type of initiatives, if we could get this bill passed, we have Senate Bill 1723, House Bill 7227. If we could get initiatives passed like this, we're really going to see, I think, an increase in the increase of culturally responsive schooling for our Native children.
Mary and Travis, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Mary Annette Pember is a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, Medicine River. She is a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Travis Miller is treasurer for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohicans from North Central Wisconsin.
Coming up, a Wisconsin band releases an album of songs inspired by the state's veterans of World War I.
Music will speak directly to your heart, directly to your soul. And the point of all of this, for me, is reaching across time and bringing the past forward.
Get a preview coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Steve Gotcher with a story about cave crawling.
For some, the thought of descending into the depths of a dark, tight cave is the stuff of nightmares. For Robert Root of Waukesha, the challenge of facing that fear was a journey he needed to take.
I'm the only one signed up for the cave tour at the Ledgeview Nature Center. But Jane Mangari, the assistant naturalist, agrees to lead it. Despite a fear of tight, dark places, I'd resolved to explore a cave. Now I have no excuse to back out. We walk to the entrance on the roofs of caves. Jane explains how the solution caves below us were carved by seepage of rain and snowmelt that sometimes became underground streams and even waterfalls. The ground beneath us is honeycombed with chambers and channels. The Carolyn's Caverns cave system is over 700 feet long. It's accessible part of the year for tours, but closed from October to May for bat hibernation. Its first room, the bat room, has an opening in its steel door for bats, big brown, little brown, long-eared, and tricolored bats, to enter and exit. Jane urges me to explore two side rooms. I smile gamely and commit myself to crawling and clambering. I squirm on my belly in and out of one narrow passage and climb down a ladder into a small enclosed space with a muddy bottom. I hope I've acclimated myself to what's ahead. We wander through other rooms and passages, stepping carefully on the uneven floor, wary of protrusions near our heads. I bend, I stoop, I crawl on my hands and knees, and I slither outright. Only one space is especially tight. Less so for Jane than for me, but crawling through passages like the whale's throat and the kid's passage means venturing into long, dark holes with no chance to raise my head or propel myself by any means other than elbows and thighs. I try not to think about getting stuck, and soon realize I don't need to think about it. When we descend to Carolyn's cave, the original entrance to the system, we're 17 feet below the surface. At the bottom of Dave's sink, the deepest room, we're 36 feet, four stories underground. At times, bending to look down a dark passage, I feel the lure of crawling in to see just how far it would take me, how tangled and interconnected the cavities might be. Jane illuminates layers of Silurian strata, fossils, miniature stalactites, chert and cave coral. She steers me around hungry mud, the sticky pools on the cave floors, remnants of times the caves have been flooded, at least once as much as 18 feet deep. By the time we make the long crawl through the whale's throat back to the bat room, I'm busy thinking about the slow and relentless formation of the caves, the scale of their existence. Despite the weight of the rock strata above me, the density of the walls around me, the impenetrable darkness beyond this room, I feel no eagerness to leave the caves. When we reach daylight, I feel no sense of relief. I suppose you could say I confronted my fear of crawling in caves and overcame it. It seems to me more likely that I was too absorbed in where I was to notice my fear. Neither the caves nor my guide would let me think about that.
Author Robert Root of Waukesha brought us that essay on cave crawling. And his story has been turned into an animation. Check it out in the newest season of PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Life or online at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
World War I doesn't always get as much recognition in popular culture and the arts as the Second World War, but a Wisconsin band is shining a light on the Great War with a new album.
The Madison-based rock band The Kissers is putting out 11 songs inspired by the stories of Wisconsinites who served in World War I, and the album comes out on Veterans Day. Their album release event tomorrow night includes displays from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.
Ken Fitzsimmons is one of the founders of The Kissers. Ken, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
So this album is inspired by a show you put on a few years back called The Greatest War, World War I, Wisconsin, and Why It Still Matters. What is it that drew you to World War I as a source of inspiration for musical material?
Well, I've always been into history, and when I was younger, I used to study war history. And I studied the Civil War and World War II, and I was at a bookstore one day, and I looked and saw, you know, between the big shelves of those of books of those wars, I saw just a few that were about World War I or the First World War. And I thought that's an awfully big title for such a small amount of attention that it's getting. And I always had this dream of mixing music and history and at the Greatest War, the visuals as well, to be more impactful.
Now, a World War I themed album of music coming out in 2024. What, as you tell the stories, and we're going to get into those stories in just a bit, what is it that speaks to you about that era, about Wisconsinites in that war today?
Well, it's a tumultuous time, to say the least, right? And not only because there's a war, but because there's also some of the harshest laws about free speech at the time. There's extreme xenophobia going on. It's mostly anti-German during the war. And so there's a lot of kind of inner conflict as well as the outer, you might say, of the war. And not to mention, there's a pandemic.
So a lot of things that might ring true for people today.
Totally.
And part of that show and of the new album, it isn't just about the broad sweep of the war, right? You are digging into the individual stories, the life experiences of people in it, people from Wisconsin. How did you start to dig into those stories?
Well, so you're right. I wanted to tell the individual stories because that, to me, is the most compelling history. I didn't want to tell the stories of just the leaders or the generals and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to dig in specifically to Wisconsinites. So I traveled to a couple of great resources here in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin State Historical Society and Museum, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. And at the Veterans Museum, they had an exhibit at the time called Beyond the Trenches, and I learned about many Wisconsinites, and they were really helpful, and they gave me lots of notes, and so I was able to dig into their stories.
We're talking about a new album of World War I-themed music from Wisconsin. Ken Fitzsimmons is with us from the Madison-based band The Kissers. Let's check out one of those songs based on the firsthand accounts of, I think, three different Wisconsinites who served. Can you first tell us a little bit about the song Dear Mother?
Sure. So the first thing I did is I read a bunch of letters home from soldiers overseas. And the soldiers, they called them the boys, you know, letters from the boys. And, you know, it's not too far off. They're very young, 18, 19. And the letters are usually addressed, Dear Mother. And then the next line is something like, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail or the chocolate you sent. And then there's this kind of awkward exchange where they try to console their mother, saying like, he should be proud, but I might not make it, but that'll be okay. And so I was intrigued by that. And then through the Veterans Museum and through some of our own research, I found three particular stories of Wisconsinites from different areas, Milwaukee, Shawano, and Stevens Point. And they each have kind of their own tale that was, I thought, compelling enough for a song.
And you've got your guitar here. Could you play Dear Mother for us?
Yeah, you bet. At Liette, went to the armory to enlist. At age 16, I had to round up 2 years more. Swear I'm in, the recruiter said, and a runner I became, passing messages from the trenches to the brass. And at Chateau Thierry, 7 runners did not survive, so the lieutenant said, well, John, you're gonna have to go. I went a crack over my head, crawled in a shallow riverbed. I ran so fast they didn't hit me, but sure they tried. Dear mother, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail you sent. And don't worry, though I might not make it home, that's sometimes how it goes. I'm sure that I'll be all right. I took a break from training the men, went to a movie in town, just the Marshfield Lieutenant and I. Sat on the floor with the revelers, with their drinking and their cigarettes. I saw a young girl away from up above. A Vusi cinema tape beyond here, so we joined her better view. Between her mother's dagger looks, we got along. I didn't catch her name, but she snatched my handkerchief with mine. A keepsake, she said, I hope we meet again. Ah, dear mother, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail you sent. And don't worry, though I might not make it home, that's sometimes how it goes. I'm sure that I'll be all right. Fresh out of Shawano High, a soldier I will be, and take part in this greatest of all wars. On the Tuscania, we sailed to the North Sea with great might. A torpedo struck our starboard side. In the dark, we found our way above deck, only to find our lifeboat destroyed and men jumping overboard. But I kept my cool, I waited for the rescue boat. Now I feel able to hold my own at any time. Dear mother,
hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail you sent. And don't worry, though I might not make it home. That's sometimes how it goes. Yeah, dear mother, hello from somewhere in France. Thanks for the mail you sent. And don't worry, though I might not make it home. Oh, that's sometimes how it goes. I'm sure that I'll be all right.
That was fantastic. Ken, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Your string held out till right at the last moment there. Amazing. Yeah. I got to say, I feel just through that song an emotional connection with the people you were singing about. And I imagine for you, having lived, you know, read these letters and worked this into the song, like you feel clearly a connection with these boys in this case.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad to hear that, Rob. And that's really the point, right? So, you know, when we talk about history or big events, we talk, you know, often in big numbers and millions of people or, you know, hundreds, you know, big armies and this and that. But it's what really impacts us is when we know the person and we know their name and we know where they're from and we know their personal story.
Not just boys, though, not just men. You also took inspiration from an Army Corps nurse from Madison in a song called Happiest Mortal. What did you learn from her?
So Helen Belovsky, I learned from the Veterans Museum and from a book by her nieces, Janice Collins and Brooke Cameron, that's a publication of all of her diaries and letters home. And she kept a pretty detailed account of her whole trip. She graduates high school in 1914, becomes a nurse at Madison General in 1917, just when war has been declared, and is moved by the parades and the call for nurses and signs up. And the day that she ships off, she calls herself the happiest mortal in town. And her letters remain pretty upbeat, although a little later they do start to shift when she says things like, you know, we sure have found real war.
Now, somebody could write a book about those things. Somebody has written books about those things. What is it about the medium of music?
Well, I'm a musician, so obviously it's my first medium. But the reason for music is because we can, you know, someone can tell us about history. We can watch a documentary, we can hear about it, and it's all important, but music will speak directly to your heart, directly to your soul. And the point of all of this for me is reaching across time and bringing the past forward. And to really feel that connection, you have to connect with the people, but in a way that perhaps I can't say, but the music can.
Ken, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Ken Fitzsimmons is one of the founders of the Madison-based band The Kissers. He was with us today to share his band's new album of World War I-themed music, The Foe and the Fallen, Songs from the Greatest War. It features the stories of Wisconsinites who served during the war. The album comes out Monday, Veterans Day. His band will be performing live at the Burr Oak in Madison on Saturday with displays from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Yesterday, I recorded an interview about volunteer firefighters in a Wisconsin community with the chief of a local volunteer department and the Wisconsin director of a new documentary about that department. It's a great conversation, inspiring. You can hear it Monday here on the show.
And we want to hear more stories about volunteer first responders in Wisconsin. Are you a volunteer firefighter or EMT, or do you want to send a shout out or thank you to your community's volunteer department? Either way, we want to hear from you.
There's two great ways to reach us. By email, our address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
You can also leave a phone message or send us a text. Either way, the number is 888-642-0232. That number again, 888-642-0232.
And we hope to share your story on a future show. Again,
Again, tell us about your volunteer firefighter experience. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.